Welcome to Cinemakers, Amy Hackerling. This is episode 55, Red Oaks, from 2014 through 2017. I'm Joey Mendesco.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Kara Gail O'Regan.
And I have to apologize to all of you. I have a cold, so you could probably hear that.
Well, I hope you feel better, boy chick.
Well, so Nash is the best part. So Red Oaks, Amy Hackerling directed six episodes, two in each of the three seasons. Two in the first, two in the second, two in the third. I realized when I was sort of thinking about the episodes on a high level, her two in the first season, I think, are maybe the two most important in the first season. And then in the second and third seasons, they're just sort of whatever episodes. But I realized that's because the show just kind of becomes, at least in my opinion, kind of whatever. Like, I love the first season. I think there's a magic to them being at the Red Oaks Country Club. And I think once the show gets away from that and just begins following the characters, to me, it becomes less interesting. It sort of becomes less special and less of what I was enjoying. But before we dive into her specific episodes, I was wondering what you two thought of the show as a whole, either season by season or on overall, or however you want to answer the question.
Well, so I actually really love this show. This is the third time that I saw these episodes in particular, because I've watched it all the way through twice. I really like it, probably because it's so familiar to me, taking place in northern New Jersey, and how it's about this weird kind of proximity to wealth that you have if you live in that area but aren't necessarily one of the rich people. You wind up working for them and getting access to all sorts of weird things. And I just think everyone's great on it. It's written really well. I don't love that the female characters don't get a ton of play, although in the episodes that we watched specifically for this podcast, they do, which is nice. And I think that they're actually only watching the six episodes kind of back to back to back are kind of almost like a movie. Like, it kind of has this arc to it overall, I think, that, like, not a great movie. There's a lot missing. But, you know, like, one of those movies that, like, show, like, three distinct points in time. I like it.
Do you like any season more than the rest, or you sort of think of it all? Because there's not a ton of this. I mean, there's 24 episodes, or 26 episodes, and, you know, you could probably watch it all in about 11 or 12 hours.
You can. I did that recently by accident when I was working on something. So, yeah.
Whoops. But, I mean, do you like the early stuff better, or do you like it all about the same, or, like, where does it fall? Because I think there's a real distinction for me early on, and we'll get to this later, when they leave the country club to go to New York, I was like, oh, this is right in Amy Hackerling's wheelhouse. We've talked about this. And then the more time they spent there, I was like, oh, like, this doesn't feel like a fun excursion. It feels like a different show.
Yeah. No, I think that's accurate. The first couple seasons are better because they do exist in that, like, small little world. But on the other hand, I think that there are some, like, character arcs that either continue into the third season or, like, pay off in the third season that I really enjoy. Like, I think that Judy, who plays the main character's mom, played by Jennifer Grey, who is amazing, and I just want her to have her own spinoff from the show, because her character goes from being this housewife in the first season who feels very, like she says herself, she's invisible, whatever, to over the course of these three seasons realizing that she's into women and maybe a little bit gay, or maybe a lot gay, and she gets divorced from her husband and she goes out on her own, and by the time the third season rolls around, she is like this big shot real estate agent who's like celebrating $1 million in sales. And so it was really great to kind of see her arc over those three seasons, even if the third season gets a little scattershot.
Refresh my memory, Kara, but in the pilot, isn't there like a kind of a throwaway line about baby? I'm just going to call her baby. About the mom, that like she's into women. It's sort of established from the beginning, right?
Well, yeah, the very first scene of the very first episode is him playing tennis with his dad, and his dad starts having a heart attack, and he's like laying there on the ground and like saying all of these stream of consciousness things in case he doesn't get a chance to, like, if he's dying, like, he wants to get this stuff out there. And one of the things that he says is like, and I think your mom likes women or something like that, or is a little bit gay. And then you see that kind of play out over the course of the next three seasons.
Now, Mike, where do you fall on the Red Oaks? If Kara is on the mostly likes all of it, and I'm on the really likes part of it but doesn't really care for a lot of it, where do you fall on that sort of spectrum? Or are you beyond me? Like, you enjoyed none of this. Are you a Grinch for Red Oaks?
Oh, I'm certainly not a Grinch by any means. I think I'm closer to Kara's side of the tennis court there. I quite enjoyed this very much. Like, coming from the area, northern New Jersey.
Do you think that Joey doesn't like it as much because he's not from northern New Jersey? He's from central New Jersey?
I'm just glad that you acknowledge that that Central Jersey exists. So many people do not.
It's what keeps us separated from the Southland. Yeah.
We're the buffer between the water and the water.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it did a good job of being an 80s piece without being like a super nostalgia kind of thing. Like, that didn't bother me. It felt like Caddyshack, the show, to me in a lot of ways at first, but tennis instead of golf. So I really do like the stuff, the settings of Red Oaks Country Club and everything going on around there. I think, yeah, I'm mostly into the first season and a half, two seasons. I think I agree when it starts to follow the characters out of the club. It's not that I don't like where those journeys lead. I think for me, the problem is I don't really like David all that much, the main character.
Yeah, he kind of sucks.
Yeah, he's not my favorite. Like, I'm really into Missy and Wheeler. Like, that's the show. Like, I think they're great. I love, you know, Judy and Sam and everything that happens to them. I mean, I really like this cast. Nash is terrific. Paul Reiser's great in this. So I was really digging it. I was really loving the vibe. It was giving me a lot of 80s sort of feels, but like not overkilling it or anything. You know, maybe I think once the show moved to New York and got out of the club, it sort of became, like you said, Joey, sort of another show. It evolves. You know, maybe it should have changed the name or something, or it feels like a spinoff almost in the third season. But overall, I was like pretty impressed with this. You know, we're very familiar with Soderbergh, Joey, and he is all over this show. And one of the creators, Gregory Jacobs, has also been a producer for a ton of Soderbergh material that we've covered, and, you know, lots of other great things too. So there's a lot of great stuff behind the scenes. David Gordon Green is involved. You know, he directed Joe, starring Cage, one of Cage's best performances.
Well, Soderbergh also produced the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of good talent behind it, and I think it shines through. Maybe part of the issue is that it was on Amazon. I think this and The Tick are the only two shows I've watched on Amazon in their entirety, and like, I just, you know, it's hard for me to find time to watch shows in general because there's just so many and stuff, but I would definitely recommend this one. I mean, we're going to get into it, of course, but for me, just right off the bat, what was weird is I'm surprised that Heckling like wasn't involved more in this, that she only directed 6 episodes, because it felt like her sensibilities from the start. Like, it started off feeling a lot like Clueless. It ends up feeling a lot like Fast Times. Like, there's a lot of that stuff going on, so I understand, you know, why she's involved, and I definitely feel like her style and her view and everything fit in perfectly with this material. I'm glad I finally got a chance to watch this show. I had been told to watch it several times. I liked it.
On the one hand, on the glass half empty thing, you could say that she wasn't involved in a lot of it, but on the glass half full, she did direct like almost a quarter of the episodes. There's only like 3 or 4 directors.
Yeah, it seems like they like assigned everyone like a few like episode arcs. Because, like, they're, like, back-to-back people that got to direct instead of random.
Yeah, so there's, like, Hal Hartley, who did a bunch, and David Gordon Green did a bunch, and she did a bunch, and maybe a couple other people.
Yeah. Andrew Fleming, who wrote and directed both The Craft and Dick. I was excited to see his name pop up there, too. Yeah.
The show got to the point where it felt to me like the easiest way I can describe it is, like, what all Showtime shows become in seasons 5 through 8, where they're like, oh, we love these characters so much, we don't have a reason. It is almost the exact definition of jumping the shark, which, you know, if you don't know, comes from Happy Days, where Fonzie actually jumped over a shark, and people were like, oh, this is not the show that it was at one point. And so the show, the idea for the show is, like, let's follow these characters around at a country club. And then as soon as you realize, oh, they're not going back there, they're not going to all be back there, it's a different show, which is not bad. But I think the show that I fell in love with was that first season. So, like, if I watch this again, I think I might just watch the first season and then sort of be done with it. Like, I like where characters go. Like, I like that Misty and Wheeler get together in the end, that he wins out because he is such a good, pure soul. Like, I like that he gets the girl of his dreams and that she realizes that there's more to life than just looks. But I kind of like the idea of the first season more, even though I don't dislike the second and third. It just feels like a different show that wasn't why I love the first season.
Yeah, I hear you too. And I think it felt a little truncated for me as well. Like, it felt like, I know they're short seasons and everything, but it felt like episodes were kind of missing to me. Like, there could have been more episodes per season, or like certain episodes seemed to feel like scenes were missing, or, you know, I felt like I missed something between scenes here and there from time to time and stuff. So like, I also just like by its structure, it felt like it was rushing a little bit to me through things, and that I wish it kind of could have taken its time a little bit more. But I don't know if you guys got a sense of that at all. That could strictly just be from me. But where I'm going with that is like, I just would have loved to have seen maybe more from certain characters and less focus on others. You know, like I love how much they focus on Nash, but I would have liked to have seen more of like where Barry and Karen ended up, you know, in like season three. Like we get little, like they pop in, they, you know, they end up married, that whole thing. But like, I don't know, I really enjoyed Karen a lot, and she sort of just like drifted into the background. Sky also disappears. Paul Reiser gets through. That's a very interesting arc with his character Getty, who he plays sort of like a Wolf of Wall Street type guy. But yeah, just overall, I kind of, maybe I just wanted a little more show, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I felt it especially in these Heckerling episodes whenever there was like a montage there, because there are like a few great ones, especially like right before they're setting up for the 4th of July party. And I was like, oh no, it's too short. Like it just was like, here's a taste and now it's over because this episode is only 24 minutes or whatever. And that was where I was really like, oh no, just give me more montages.
Yeah. You know, you said, Mike, that Getty reminds you that Paul Reiser plays, I think he's incredible. Like, he and Richard Kind are so goddamn good on the show. The thing, like, well, to sort of detour from my own point for a second, like, Richard Kind, like, I love him as this sad, vulnerable man whose life is falling apart. He's trying to make sense of it. I don't really care that he opens a sandwich shop. Like, that just feels like too much. You know what I mean? Like, I don't need to see that.
I thought it was interesting. His boss was an interesting character, right? Because, like, I thought that was pretty well represented, because you know he has the crutches, but they're never mentioned whatsoever, and he's just, you know,
he's just a normal character. Like he just, it's the same thing as like advice that's given to writers, like, hey, take some of your background character guys and make them women, or make them a different race, and it like doesn't change anything and it's fine, and then you just have a more diverse representation. So it's cool that they do that, although I don't think that actor is actually disabled in real life. I tried to find out, couldn't, so who knows.
I mean, you could also make your star that way. It's a sort of detour once again. But like, one of my favorite movies from last year was this movie called Hearts Beat Loud, where the main character is a black lesbian woman. And like, none of that matters to the story. Like, she's just a girl coming of age and like trying to go off to school. And like, the fact that she's black or that she, you know, likes girls, like whatever, it doesn't matter. It's just representation and like an actual character. So I agree wholeheartedly. Make more people not straight white dudes. Although the straight white dudes in this one, at least the older generation, Getty and Richard Kind, so great. David, you know, maybe make him literally anybody else, because...
Well, so the thing that where I get kind of confused about why I like this show so much is because it is very much from, like, even though we follow some of the female characters on their own journeys, it's still very much from a male point of view, and the men are still very much the stars and the centers of this show. David in particular revolves entirely around him. And a lot of the female characters, I think Skye in particular is the one that annoys me the most, because she is so underdeveloped and has some very like distinct character traits that maybe are a little bit too much like me, and I also don't like that. But like the fact that she remains this kind of manic pixie dream girl and doesn't really get any farther, I don't know, I just always found that somewhat perplexing, because I'm like, but I don't understand why I'm still enjoying this much if it's, you know, such a like fixed perspective.
Well, I think there is, and I just realized this now, that there's sort of, and it's not great for the overall representation of the women, but there's kind of like the, you know, like his summer crush each year, and there's a different girl each season. Like there's Karen, and then there's Skye, and then there's a girl whose name I don't know, the one who works with him.
I call her Wardrobe Cutie. I don't know her name either, but she's cute.
She is, like, she's definitely the pure, I mean, Karen is pure of heart, even though she loves Barry, who is... the worst.
But even that guy is great. Like, how do I enjoy that so much? I don't understand.
I don't know, because he's so committed to what he is. But I feel like each season there's just like a, oh, this is the girl that David is smitten with for these 6 or 10 episodes. You know what I mean? Like, it's like having a girlfriend every year in college, or like a different summer crush every year. Like, that's not great. Like, I'd rather see Karen continue through to season three. But at the same time, you then, like, run into, like, what I was saying before about the Showtime shows. Like, all of a sudden, you're, like, weed season seven, and, like, Doug is just hanging around because, like, we don't want to get rid of Kevin Nealon. And, like, we don't want to get rid of him, but, like, we don't have anything for him to do. So he's just, like, sitting around smoking weed. It's just like, well, I think at some point you kind of have to cut bait, Mike. And I think, like, I agree with both things you're saying. Like, I wish that there was, you know, more, like, focus paid to other people. But at the same time, like, you kind of got to just, like, pick and choose your battles, right? And, like, she's not ultimately important because, like, because this is all through, as you've both been saying, through David's perspective. And, like, Karen's influence on his life is done, right? So, like, she sort of run her course. And, you know, she can have a great life, which she seems to have. Like, after he fixes her wedding, basically, which is sort of problematic, maybe. But, like, after he fixes her wedding, you know, she's like, oh, I'm good now. And, like, that's sort of, like, the kiss goodbye, and now they're good.
Yeah, I like how he's able to remain friends with Karen in that. I just wish that she was getting in and out of jams more and, like, part of the crew, I guess. But I think, like, the show understood, like, because Sky isn't really in season three. She's in, like, one scene or something, right? So, like, the show understood, like, she kind of, like, when certain characters are sort of, like, run their course. Because she also, that's an interesting situation because, you know, there's that whole power play between her dad and David. Like, David is in love with her and her dad hates David, but it needs his help. And there's this weird sort of, like, you know, trying to groom him situation. And it's all very sort of difficult to navigate. And so there's a lot of stuff going on there. And I think, right, once that sort of plays out and that her dad goes to jail, or I guess when she goes to Paris and comes back, then, you know, it's over. And so season three, yeah, it's the focus is on other things. But I don't know. I wondered at points, you know, why do I like this even if I don't like this or that about it? And I think about that with other shows that I like so much and rewatch things, and it's like, oh, I hate this about it, but I still love this in its totality, like, in full. Maybe we're not supposed to like David. Like, maybe that's part of it. That's the point, is, like, when we look back on these times and these people and these situations, like, yeah, like, they're not doing the right thing. This isn't good. They're not exactly good people through and through, and the facade is there. Because there's a thing sort of like with Nash, it's the opposite. Like, at first I was like, oh, this guy is kind of like a jerk, like he's all like this arrogant kind of asshole kind of thing, but actually he turns out to be like a really sweet, nice, caring kind of guy who really tries to help people out and stuff. So, like, I don't know, I wonder sometimes, like, if it's trying to manipulate me that way.
My other big complaint about this show is that no one is appropriately sweaty. It's summer in New Jersey.
And they're all exercising all the time.
Yeah, but everyone is, like, not shiny. And I don't understand why. There's that episode when when David and Sky are in the city. She is wearing opaque black tights and a jacket. And it's summer. And it's so hot.
The drug dealer is sweaty a lot, and Wheeler is sweaty sometimes, but I feel like that's more maybe, like, the actor actually being sweaty as opposed to the character being sweaty.
Yeah. Yeah, those two are appropriately sweaty.
One thing, this goes back to the point I started to make 8 minutes ago before I derailed myself. You said that Getty reminds you of Wolf of Wall Street. So he and Mrs. Getty, played by Gina Gershon, and Sky reminded me so much. It started with Sky, then I was like, wait a minute, this whole family reminded me a lot of Tony, Carmela, and Meadow because of the criminal enterprise, the North Jersey setting. But just, like, Sky and Meadow are both, like, whiny, entitled girls, I think. And then I feel like Mrs. Getty and Carmela are both, like, first seen as, like, the trophy wife, but then have much more complicated stories than you might think. And then, you know, Getty and Tony are both sort of, in a way, public figures that are also criminal leaders in a way. It's obviously not as about crime as The Sopranos is, but the first season does end with Getty getting arrested for insider trading and all this different stuff. So I was sort of surprised, and maybe that's just North Jersey in the 80s, but or the 90s or whatever, but, you know, that parallel really struck me while watching.
Well, I think it's also partially part of the whole underlying thing about the wealth going on and and all that, and, you know, where it comes from and who has it and what the, because, like, Getty's even like, oh, I'm president of the country club, you know, like, he has to be the, like, it just seems like he's not just accumulating wealth but power and all this other kind of stuff. It just made me wonder, like wealthy people, like, and how they got their wealth. And I just thought that was an interesting sort of aspect of the show.
Let's talk about now that we've sort of talked about the show as a whole, let's talk about Amy Heckerling's episode specifically. Before we get there, though, I want to say, these are things that I noticed about the show that, like, fit, like, we talked about how it fits in with her sensibilities, but obviously the 80s, obviously great clothes, great soundtracks, everybody kind of just wants to get laid, there's a lot of dream sequences and montages.
If I may, perhaps the ultimate Heckerling altered state sequence in Body Swap.
which I love and also have problems with, which we will get to. They also, this is not one of the episodes that she directed, but they used the bridge and tunnel. Like, Skye says that David's a bridge and tunnel kid. And I was like, oh, shit, we talked about that on Loser, which I'd never heard of before we did this podcast. And now I've heard twice for this podcast.
And which actually turns out to be something of a theme in her later TV work. So I actually spent the weekend watching almost all of the TV episodes that she directed, which included 2 episodes of Gossip Girl and 1, 2, 3 episodes of a show called The Carrie Diaries.
Sex and the City prequel?
Yeah, which it turns out is a really great show, and I might actually go back and watch The Carrie Diaries. It was, of all of the TV that I watched this weekend, probably some of the best. But in one of the episodes of Gossip Girl, they, like, go to a bar downtown to escape one of their ex-boyfriends who's stalking them. And the character says, like, oh, I've never been so excited to be surrounded by so many bridge and tunnel types. And there's a lot of, like, bridge and tunnel-ness about the Carrie Diaries, too. So, yeah.
Huh. Wow. And also, just while it's on my mind before we get into the Amy Heckling's episodes, Mike, I caught at least 3 Tom Cruise references. Because it's on the brain. Number 1, Wheeler, I can't go to military school. Did you see Taps? Those guys are psychos, which we just covered.
Caught that.
They also talked about Top Gun, like, in the same episode, they talked about Top Gun. And then later, Wheeler says something, I think it was Wheeler, who says something like, I don't exactly look like Val Kilmer, which is clearly still, I mean, 80s as a whole, but also probably Top Gun. So I was like, oh shit, boy do we have a podcast for you, television show.
I thought it was funny at one point where they go to see Aliens, and the guy makes a reference to Paul Reiser's character from the movie, and my brain almost snapped for a second, but...
Okay, so Body Swap, Season 1, Episode 7. This is very much Amy Heckerling. This is where David and his father swap bodies.
And they're so good at being each other.
My one friend, when I was talking to my fantasy baseball league, take a drink, about the show, because a handful of them had seen it already, my one friend said that after that happened and then they swapped back, they never stopped seeing David as Richard Kind. So I was like, oh, I kind of wish that I watched the show like that, that always just has 2 Richard Kinds on screen. I love this episode because of their performances. I hate that the show never attributes, like, they just forget everything and it's never reminded of again. Even though in this world, in the next episode, David goes and apologizes to Skye, like, you know, if I was weird yesterday, I just want to let you know that I was sick, I was on, you know, medication or whatever. I love that this exists, that this, like, very weird thing that does not have anything to do with the rest of the show happens, and then it's all just for naught, really. So, like, that bothers me.
Oh, you think it doesn't have anything to do with the rest of the show? That's interesting. Because to me, like, so much of this show, especially leading up to that episode, is about this, like, generational divide and this conflict between David and his parents, like, particularly his father, and, like, them having a hard time finding empathy for anyone other than themselves. And I think that that experience kind of opens them up a little bit to that. And you see it in the rest of the series, even though they never actually, like, acknowledge it.
Yeah, like, I'm torn on this episode, really, because my main concern with it was it just comes out of nowhere. Like, there's no precedent set for anything getting this over the top crazy and wacky, except for we're in the 80s, and there were a lot of body swap movies in the 80s. There were a lot of Freaky Friday remakes, and there was, like, Father Like Son and vice versa and all kinds of shit. So, like, I'm okay with it in a whole because I like what you're saying about it, Kara. Like, I really love the therapy scene where David is his father in therapy with his mother. It's just insane. Because later in the, I think, like, season 3, we get a scene where David's in therapy with his mother when she's coming out to him, and he's like, can totally handle it and stuff. So I do feel like there's repercussions to the episodes that stick, but I'm also frustrated that there's no direct reference to this happening, like, even between Sam and Dave. I just wish, like, there was at least one moment in another scene where they were like, you know, when we swap bodies, I realized this or what, or something, or anything. But that's kind of mm-hmm. what my issue with that episode was.
It just becomes like a latent thing that they understand about each other. But, like, what I loved about the start of this episode was that there was finally conflict. Like, the first 6 episodes of the show, there was this tension brewing that, like, Sam wants his son to follow in his footsteps and become an accountant.
More accountants, even though this didn't come from Heckerling's brain.
Yep. and wants David to follow in his footsteps, go to school for accounting. David clearly hates it, wants to pursue a career in filmmaking, study filmmaking. His mom senses that something's amiss, but like there's all this like bubbling tension, and I loved that the first episode that we were focusing on specifically for the show was the one where like the sort of the tension snapped, right? And they were like fighting, they were yelling at each other about like, I don't want to do this, well, I want you to have a career, blah, 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 blah. I love that like this is a big episode. In my mind, I was like, this is a big episode, let's give it to Amy, let's let her helm this one. And then we have the body swap, and I'm like, oh, this is so weird. And then they swap back at the end, and it's just sort of like, oh. And like, I do agree that it is important in that they are able to understand where one another is coming from. But the fact that they don't remember anything, and maybe it's just like somewhere in their DNA, they're like, I understand my dad. Because like from then on, they are the kind of like, oh, it's Father's Day. Like you want to go see a movie and drink some beers or whatever. Like they become pals again. But like, I just wish that there was, even if it was just them, like I wish that there was some like more, because if you're going to get this weird, continue the weirdness, I think.
Sure.
No, right. Go do more crazy episodes later in the show that they don't. Yeah, and I almost feel like they might have been able to get to the same conclusion another way, but maybe just didn't want to, like couldn't help themselves, or just said like, no, like we want to pay homage, you know, to this particular type of film while telling this story. And I, you know, there is, you know, that works, it's okay, but it also, you know, causes a few issues as well, unfortunately. So like it's not super clean.
I feel like if you're gonna do like pay homage to this kind of movie or this kind of like type of movie, or these tropes or whatever, like do that once per season.
Yeah, make it consistent.
In the early seasons Community, like the first three seasons, there was always like the paintball episode. You know what I mean? Like it was like a show, it was like an episode that had nothing to do really with like it made no sense within the world of the show, but it also made perfect sense within the world of the show. But like you knew each year, like when you got to that, be like, oh, this is the episode where blank, where like they do the body swap or they do whatever other 80s, you know, tropes or whatever.
Yeah, because I feel like it still works. It still works enough, right? Like because the show starts sort of crazy, wild, and out of control. Like I said earlier, like it reminded me of Caddyshack a lot. And it starts on that level. Like there's a certain energy here where like, yeah, anything can happen. This is going to get pretty crazy. Like I expect shit to go wild and nuts. And, you know, once the episode sort of like settled in and everything, I was into it, I was buying it, I was feeling it and stuff, but I was also not happy that we didn't get like not another body swap episode obviously, but like any like another theme episode.
Right. Yeah, like I love the episode as it is, but I like it less within the scope of the entire show, I guess. But yeah, I mean, I still liked it. I also loved in this episode, there's another, I don't know if this is the one you were talking about earlier, Kara, but there's the montage of Baby, of Jennifer Grey getting ready while the boys are hunting for whiskey, like they're looking for that specific bottle. That sort of reminded me of Look Who's Talking, where Kirstie Alley is getting ready. Happy belated birthday, Kirstie Alley, 68 years old, still probably looking great. Don't know what you look like in 2019, but shout out Kirstie Alley. But there was that episode that we loved, that one where like she's getting ready and she's getting ready for the date. And here it sort of reminded me of that, of, you know, another 80s montage of an attractive woman getting ready for a night of sort of unexpected or much needed passion in a way.
One of the other episodes that was not directed by Heckerling, those same therapists give Richard Kind and, damn it, now you have my brain also calling her Baby. Anyway, Jennifer Grey, where the therapist...
What's Richard Kind's character's name from Inside Out? Take her to the moon for me.
Bing Bong?
Bing Bong, yeah. So Bing Bong and Baby. That's what we can call him, Kara. Bing Bong and Baby.
So there is that episode where Bing Bong and Baby get prescribed MDMA or ecstasy, and they go home and they take it, and then they get, you know, weird. That's also a really great episode.
It was one of those episodes where, like, I hate movies and TV shows where, like, I guess this is, like, a lot of things where good intentions get spoiled. Like, because I really, for whatever reason, I wanted David and Karen to work. Because I liked Karen, I think, right? And so it's clear that they're on the rocks and that she's, you know, lusting for Barry. Or, you know, at least entertaining the notion that Barry's maybe the right guy for her. Because David can't do things right. He's just a kid. And, like, he does this thing where maybe it's not what Barry would have done. But he, you know, has forethought. He buys her. He makes the chocolate dip strawberry. Strawberries, gets the champagne, does all the rose petals, all this different stuff. And then, you know, after this shitty night where he doesn't make a reservation, gets home, and it's like, this is going to win it over. It's all for naught. And I just felt so bad, not really for him, but for Karen on her birthday. And I was like, that hurt me, that I enjoyed watching Bing Bong and Baby, you know, in their underwear, just like, you know, getting weird with the universe. But I felt like Karen, you know, that she could have had a special night, but they had to, you know, get high and ruin it. But I don't know. That's just my weird brain.
Well, welcome to dating men.
But you know what I thought was an interesting part of the body swap episode was at the end when Sky and Karen finally meet. I was like, oh, cool. This is interesting. Like, that's cool. I'm glad we get places in there in that episode that, you know, mean things. So, like, that's good. Like, there are some good moments that stick.
I like that, yeah, because David in Sam's body is like, there's one thing, don't talk to a girl named Sky. And then he has this whole conversation. It's just like, oh, I'm Sky. He's like, oh, no, like, I did the one thing I wasn't supposed to do. But that was great. I also love just his, like, absolute obsession and adoration of fried food. Like, I can't eat this anymore, but, like, oh, food is so good. Just eating, like, the worst food in the world. So we follow up Body Swap with After Hours, which is an episode that follows the movie format, I think, right, called After Hours. And what excited me about this one is that this is our first trip to New York City, which we've talked about a bunch. That's where Amy Heckerling is from. This is sort of her bread and butter. And again, in my head, I was like, oh, cool, like, this is what she's good at. Let's give her this episode.
Did you guys see the background dicks?
Oh, yeah, the red, white, and blue one.
Yeah, there. I noticed some extra dicks this time that I had not seen previously. There's another, like, art installation that's just a blender that has dildos in it, and I appreciated
that.
Well,
what I noticed about the dicks was that, just like in a lot of her other things, like Fast Times and Clueless, there's a cut that goes from the red, white, and blue dick to an ice cream cone. I was like, once again, food as phallus, so.
So the ice cream place that Misty brings Wheeler to on their date that she doesn't realize is a date until it's too late, that's King Cohen. That's right across the street from my old primary care provider's office.
Oh.
I have this weird, like, superpower of, like, reverse location scouting when I'm watching things, which has gotten intense now that they're shooting so many things around where I live, but this show in particular, I'm like, oh, that's that place, and that place, and that place. It's exciting.
Yeah, no one really shoots things around here where I live, but when I watch movies set in Austin, even though I was only there for 2 years, like, there's one scene, and I don't know if either of you listened to our Boyfriend Material episode of Song to Song, the Terrence Malick, but there's one scene where, like, one of the characters, I think it might have been Gosling, pulls off the highway into, like, this parking lot, just gets out of his car and, like, yells because it's a Terrence Malick movie and everybody's angsty, and I was like, I know that parking lot. Like, I've gotten fast food in that parking lot. Like, there's, like, a Sears or something, not Sears, but, like a big department store there, and, like, there's a fast food place. Like, I was like, I know that weird parking lot. So it is a weird sort of sense of, like, not deja vu, but, like, oh, I know that place. It's very cool. There's also a great double date across space and time, sort of. And this is also a big episode in that this is where I wrote down, it's all happening, where Misty and Wheeler sort of, like, that they kind of realize, I think that Misty kind of realizes that maybe is more here. And this is where Sky and David get together only to break up in the next episode, only to get back together in the 10th episode, which has, again, like, the love that I have for the first season, where the final line of the first season is, no, come find me in Paris. And I was like, oh, I love that. And then it's all sort of downhill in my eyes a little bit from there. But this is all where things start happening. Like, it feels like so much of the show, not really in a bad way, was kind of treading water. And then we get the conflict in the last one. And here we get, like, the relationships that start, like, bubbling up. And I was like, oh, like, this is, again, another important episode. And I was so glad that she was the one who got to direct it.
Yeah, and that scene where David asks Guy out and she's like, meet me out front in 5 minutes or whatever. She gets up and starts walking away and then she stops and the camera is, like, on her backside. And then she, like, picks her wedgie in a sexy way and keeps walking. And I just appreciated that so much because I feel like a male director could have shot Sky walking away in so many other ways that would have objectified her body in a different and more voyeuristic way, whereas this one kind of puts her in the driver's seat almost, and she does a thing that's, like, not generally sexy, but, like, does it in a sexy way, and I just appreciated Heckerling's eye on that.
I like the moment when Missy was trying to teach Wheeler how to swim. I thought that was pretty cute, and I don't know. There was something about that just, like,
it's so intimate, yeah.
Yeah, and the trust there and everything, and yeah, and everyone, and he's so unguarded at that moment, whereas usually he just seems to be so confident, and this is girl of his dreams, and she's starting to think, like, maybe this guy's more than just, you know, a pothead, and he turns out to be, which is interesting. But yeah, that was a really nice moment too, that I thought you did a great job of sort of just bringing out, like, the tenderness there.
Oh, one thing you just reminded me of in ways completely unrelated to what you were saying, can we talk for a second about how the pilot for this was clearly made for, like, HBO or Showtime, where, like, everyone got naked, like, Misty got naked, like, she got topless, and, like, there was a lot more swearing, and there's, like, there was nudity in even in, like, the opening credits that went away. Like,
yeah, that's what I meant when I was saying it was, like, crazy and, like, a party from the start where, like, anything goes. And it's like, yeah, because Nash is having, like, a
three-way on the golf course, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a strip mini golf game, like on the course and stuff. It's crazy.
And then there's the thing where, like, you know, Wheeler and Misty go on the date, and he's like, let's do something crazy or whatever, and she, like, takes her shirt off and jumps in the water, and then everyone else at Red Oaks, like, gets naked and jumps in the water, too. I was like, what is this show? And then the second episode has the opening credits with, like, the topless scene from, like, the women's locker room or whatever cut, and I was like, oh, okay. Now, I mean, like, you can still show whatever you want on Amazon, but I guess Amazon was more like, let's, like, keep it more TV-14 with, like, some language, but it was such a weird, jarring jump from, you know, hard R to, like, kind of PG-13.
Amazon had such a crazy way of getting their shows done, right? Like, they would do pilot season, they would release, like, 4 or 5 new pilots, and then they'd let everybody watch them and vote on which ones they liked, and then they'd pick them up based on the viewers' ratings of them and stuff. So, like, I don't remember what else was out around this time. I think Zombieland even had a pilot episode, and it was just, like, miserable. It was, I mean, especially compared to that awesome movie. Everything kind of shifts from pilot to episode 2 a little bit, but possibly they were just trying to really get this, like, get some numbers on this show, get this going.
And I feel like this is something that I've seen before, where, like, the first episode is, like, more graphic and explicit than the rest of the show, but then it sort of tampers down a bit. The Amazon pilot season is weird. Like, I've never watched any of those pilots because, like, I don't want to love and lose, you know, although I guess it's better than to never have loved at all or whatever, but, like, I don't want to watch a show that I love the idea of so much and then, like, see it never get me. Like, that's sad to me, but, you know, it is what it is. Kara, do you have anything else to say about After Hours?
She uses a bunch of archival footage of New York City, which I don't think in most of the other city-centric episodes we really see much of. Because we saw that, like, some of that in Loser, I think, and some of that in Vamps. Also, some colored lighting that was good. Just little technical touches.
The next episode that she directed was The Briss, season 2, episode 4, which I don't have a lot of notes about.
Oh, I have so many notes about this one.
The one thing I want to point out, my one big thing, was that she cast... Again, I don't know, do either of you know how much say she or any of the directors have, who are sort of, like, more hired guns than, like... Like, there's... In TV now, there's, like, you know, people, like, I think Jeremy Saulnier is now doing the entire new season of True Detective. Like, True Detective has, like, a different director each season, where I'm sure they work with the creator, the showrunner, to, like, pick their casting or whatever. But, like, how much say does Amy Heckerling have in casting characters for her episodes?
Oh, I have no idea. TV directing is very confusing. It's been explained to me on multiple occasions, and every time I just kind of gloss over, so I don't know.
Yeah, I've heard a bunch of different things. Like, sometimes I hear, like, what I'm hearing now on, like, The Mandalorian is, like, Jon Favreau and them, like, the producers, like, they chose their directors and they're sort of sitting in on the writing room and they have say, and so, like, everyone knows what's going on with everyone else's episodes. And then I hear stuff from, like, Kevin Smith when he talks in his podcast about directing, like, Supergirl, and he's like, that thing's just a well-oiled machine. I'm basically there to say action and a little more than that, and, like, give them some, like, cues and things, but people know what they're doing and the show is just, like, on its own. But I don't know, this to me kind of feels like, since we were talking, like, you know, there's not that many directors and they're all sort of doing back-to-back episodes and stuff, I kind of get the feeling that, like, they all might have been more involved and a little more than usual, and this being, like, an Amazon project, and I don't know, it just feels to me like everybody can maybe stamp it a little more personally if they wanted to, like, here and there, little touches and things like that, because I definitely do feel like episodes feel stylistically different here and there, you know, from time to time and stuff. And it's like, oh, okay, there's a flourish or there's a little touch or something they're able to sort of put in there. But generally on the whole, like, it all kind of falls under one same style. Like, I don't feel like no episode is radically different than the other.
Right. Like, there's probably, like, a style guide or something. But the reason I was asking is because in both this episode and the next episode, she casts, or we're introduced to characters who go beyond her episodes, but that sort of fit something that we've seen before, where she casts comedians in parts. Like, she casts Beth Stelling, who I love, as Baby's love interest, who is also a stand-up comedian in this world. And then, I'm assuming Amy Heckerling or whoever, cast John Hodgman as the guy who runs that, like, public access or whatever the music video place.
He's so good as that character.
There was the one scene where he's walking around, like, with a slightly visible plumber's crack for the entire scene. I was like, I can't get this out of my brain.
While we're quickly on casting, what blew my mind was the other half of Perfect Strangers, Mark Lynn Baker, is in this, and Amy Heckerling, you know, dated Bronson Pinchot, so, like,
oh.
My mind snapped again.
Wow. And that's a sneak preview for the Leftovers podcast, which Kara and I will be doing at some point. But we had seen a lot where, especially in Loser, there was a lot of, like, David Spade was in that one scene or whatever. Like, it seems like she casts comedians in, like, small parts in her movies, or, you know, famous funny people or whatever. And here it was just sort of, like, a pleasant surprise to see these two actors that I like as comedians being actors in this show, and both being sort of that, like, mix between drama and comedy, and, you know, really nailing their roles.
I agree.
Yeah, I actually, you know, I think there's a lot of great performance. You know, we mentioned Richard Kind before too, but I think, I don't know this, the guy who plays Wheeler, I've never seen him before. I thought for sure he was Jonah Hill's brother. I mean, he looks just like him. Like, it's crazy. But I think he's in Office Christmas Party as, like, an extra. I saw him in that, but he's great.
I know him from Californication. He plays David Duchovny's son, and he is the worst. But he's also supposed to be the worst in that show. Because, like, imagine David Duchovny, who it looks like David Duchovny, and then for him to have this, like, son that looks like and acts like, kind of acts like this kid, but, like, not as smart and more annoying. And it's like, oh, like, that's the whole joke there. Like, he's a unattractive son of a beautiful man or whatever. So, like, I didn't like him from that, so I was sort of put off by him here, but I really loved him here, so, you know, he won me over.
And Paul Reiser, I mean, he was a stand-up comedian, right? Yeah. And he's just, his character in this, he nails it so well. And this is the episode where he brings David to New York City to have lunch with him and whatever. And there's this scene where they're sitting at this table in this, like, fancy business restaurant where they're, you know, all of these rich men doing rich man lunchtime things. And it really reminded me of this scene from Fast Times at Ridgemont High when Ratner takes what's her name on that date and they're sitting in those chairs that are too big for them. Because David's wearing a suit jacket that's, like, just a little bit too big, and he's, like, trying to cut this giant steak in a way that makes him really look like a child next to this man who is, like, this pinnacle of wealth and power.
Can one person eat all this meat? One man can.
Yeah, and he's just sitting there, like, pointing out all the other rich guys and power dynamics and that sort of thing that I found really interesting.
You know what I loved about this episode, at least in terms of her work, and I'm sort of sad that we didn't get it, but I understand why. But obviously with an episode named, like, The Briss, there's going to be a Briss in it. And we have a baby on screen who has that done, who has his, you know, ritual circumcision done. But I was like, I wish we could hear this baby's thoughts. Like, that's when I want Bruce Willis to pop in and just be like, what's going on here? And then, like, oh my god, like, you know, that would have been, there's not that many babies in the show, and we get one in the Amy Heckerling episode, and I was like, come on, man, like, give us a Bruce Willis. Just have him drop in.
So the scene before the actual Briss itself, he is visiting Skye at work and talking to her coworker, who is also a filmmaker. And he asks her, like, what kind of movies she makes, and she rattles off a bunch of kind of, like, art house avant-garde filmmakers. And then she asks him, like, what kind of stuff he does, and he's like, oh, I'm filming a Briss tomorrow. And it cuts from them having that conversation to a shot of cold cuts on a table and, like, pans over the table to a bunch of tiny cocktail wieners. And I thought that was great. And you also, in that scene, she mixes in a lot of the viewfinder footage. So you actually, like, see David's view through his camera of what's going on. I liked that.
Oh, yeah. I liked when they did that quite often, like when he was filming the episode where he was filming the sex tape for the couple. Like, that was cool because you just see the, like, the terrible resolution of VHS for what it was. And it was funny because I was watching this off Amazon in 4K, but they would cut to that footage and it'd be like, oh,
any other thoughts about the Briss before we get on to Independence Day?
I wrote down Gina Gershon's name in all caps because she's great in this show. And I want her and Jennifer Grey's character to, like, have their own spinoff show.
And fall in love with each other.
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. Please. For the love of God. Where they, like, have, like, a real estate firm. The two of them are sisters, are doing it for themselves.
Yeah. Just, like, Bound too. I don't think I know Gina Gershon from a lot of stuff, but I know her from Bound, and she's great in Bound.
Oh, she's good in everything. Yeah, this is the one with the karaoke scene, right?
Independence Day or the Briss?
The Briss. I think that happens in the Briss.
Oh, when Richard Kind gets stood up on a date, and then Baby is there with, like, a bunch of her friends, and she sees him up on stage.
And it's just, it's such a beautiful scene, I think, because he gets up on stage and he's like a little bit drunk and lonely and sad because he's gotten stood up. And like, as the music swells, kind of his mood turns around and he's up there really like giving it his all and having a lot of fun while she's standing there. And like, her mood is kind of diving in the other direction because here she's seeing this person that she used to love, like, ostensibly having a good time without her. And I just found that to be like a really, really beautiful moment. And we don't get to see women think on screen a lot, you know? And I think that, well, with the exception of all of these movies that we've watched for Cinemaker's Amy Heckerling, that's not something we get to see a lot. So I always appreciate it when somebody lets a camera linger on a woman's face for a while, especially if that woman is slightly older. We especially don't get to see that.
I also do want to point out before my card gets revoked that I do know Gina Gershon, of course, from Face Off. So I want to make sure that I get that in there. I'm looking on Letterboxd right now. She's in Blockers, Face Off, Pretty in Pink, Killer Joe, Bound. I've seen her all those. She's going to be in an upcoming Cruise Club, Mike, Cocktail.
Oh, I love that one. It's a great movie.
So that's going to be a, I think that's going to be a P.S. Love Hoffman reunion on our show. So go check out that podcast and go check out our podcast where Kyle and Brian are just going to swing by. But the next episode that Amy Heckerling directed is season 2, episode 5, Independence Day, where we're introduced to John Hodgman. I said that there's a real focus on male genitalia. I don't remember how, but there's just a lot of dicks around, I would assume. And I also, I think we've talked about before about how Amy Heckerling is Jewish, right?
Yes. Yeah, I just wrote down the word Judaism and I don't remember why.
Yes, because my note was, again, this is sort of like, I watched a lot of these in a very compressed amount of time, but I wrote down that it makes sense that even though this whole show is very Jewish, like, everything about the show, and not in, like, a bad way, it's just, you know, not, like, in a stereotypical way.
No, just in, like, this takes place in northern New Jersey, so, you know, yeah.
Yes. And all the characters are Jewish, that it makes sense that even though this whole show is very Jewish, the real emphasis on faith in these episodes track with her history. Like, it feels like there's, like, a weighty symbolism that, again, in my head, they're like, oh, let's give these episodes to her, where there's, like, the Jewish ritual, or there's, like, you know, there's all this meaning and, you know, symbol and custom applied to things.
Oh, right, because Nash decides that he's gonna convert to Judaism, right? Mm.
Yes. For the Widow Horowitz.
Also, Skye wears a really cute hat in this episode. Her hair is just always so good.
Did you like the Wardrobe Cutie's hat that she wore in a bunch of season 3?
Yeah, it was fine. Although, I mean, for a Wardrobe Cutie, she could do better. But it's very, I just watched When Harry Met Sally on New Year's Eve, and Meg Ryan wears a similar hat in that movie. So it made me think of that.
My only other note for this show, or this episode, was that the ending emotional montage on fireworks makes this whole episode worth it. I felt like this wasn't, like, necessarily a great episode, but I thought that, again, it's sort of this, like, moment where everyone is sort of dealing with these, like, deep thoughts spread across wherever they are, but they're all able to see the fireworks, and they're all just sort of thinking about it. And it's kind of, in a way, like a montage, but not really. It's just sort of cutting back and forth between a lot of different people, and it's this sort of beautiful way to end the episode that kind of redeems a lot of what otherwise starts to become the episodes where, like, it's kind of just, like, things happen without really much of a through line other than, like, David is not good.
Yeah, no, that scene with the fireworks is really beautiful, and I think is kind of similar to the karaoke scene in the previous episode. And like, all this time we've been talking about Heckerling as a comedy director, but she really is so adept at directing drama too. Like, there was an episode of the Carrie Diaries that I watched where one of the characters thinks that they might have AIDS, and it's like a really, like, serious, heavy episode, and it's directed so, like, effortlessly and beautifully. And I think she doesn't get enough respect in general, but also specifically for that.
Yeah,
and this show doesn't really go too dramatic that often either, or it doesn't get super heavy like that, you know what I mean? Like, it could use a little more of that in some of the other episodes, but it is interesting how she's able to really bring that in and it feel natural. Like, I remember there's a moment in Independence Day episode where Getty tells his wife he's gonna, like, reject the plea deal, and, like, she goes from being so excited that there's a plea deal, and then from him rejecting it to, like, calling him an asshole and, like, storming off and everything. I was like, wow, like, that just, like, the tone there just shifted on a dime, like, real seamlessly and everything. I was, like, not expecting it to go in that direction.
Yeah, neither is Getty.
No, not at all.
Anything else about season two as a whole is just sort of like, it's the sky season, I guess.
I like in general just how episodes were sort of like, you know, the bris, bar mitzvah, Independence Day, Father's Day, Memorial Day.
But what's interesting about this show is that they kind of almost never get a sense of the passage of time, even though the seasons take place over the course of a summer. So you would think that, like, from the start of one season to, like, you definitely get a sense of, like, character arcs, but not necessarily of, which I guess probably has a lot to do with the fact that they're shooting these in short periods of time and whatever, but like you don't see the grass change color or like anything to like note that marking of time, except I guess, you know, the holiday episodes.
It almost feels like the show was preemptively trying to not retread on itself, where it was like, well, we can only have one season of the Country Club, because if we do it more than once, we're going to tell the same stories, which I don't think that's true.
No, I think you could have had, like, the same. It would have been funny if that season two, there was also, like, Bar Mitzvah 2, Independence Day 2, like, the Bris again, you know, like, another Memorial Day. Like, that could have been a kind of funny running thing that they did.
It feels like the show was afraid for one reason or another to do the same sort of thing or to show the passage of time through a summer where, like, I almost got the sense that, like, you know, in season two where we open, like, basically right around New Year's, where David flies to Paris and is there with Skye, then Skye's parents show up. I was like, is this whole season gonna take place in winter? I mean, I don't know if either of you guys watched, do either of you watch Shameless on Showtime?
No, everybody's too mean to each other.
Because Shameless tells a story about, like, underprivileged people, like, an underprivileged family in Chicago, usually in winter, where life is more miserable. But then every once in a while, like, there'd be, like, a season where it's just, like, summer. And it's like, oh, like, this is what we're doing. And, like, it's just hot now. And it feels like that's, like, a very winter show. And then all of a sudden, like, every two or three seasons or whatever, it'd be like, oh, it's summer now. And I don't watch that show anymore. I don't know if it's still doing that. Carrie, your co-host Jordan's younger sister is like the biggest Shameless fan that I've ever met. Shout out Ali PC. But I just feel like this show, it was almost like, oh, this is going to be the winter season. But then it's not. It's just like a winter episode and a half. And then we're kind of back in Country Club-ish, but not also not really, not quite. I don't know. It just feels this weird, like, fear to just spend summer, summer, summer each season, even though that's what the show kind of is, or should be, or whatever. Maybe in my head.
No, in mine too. I was kind of afraid. I was a little like, uh-oh, like, in episode one of season two, when it was, like, Paris, I was like, are we jumping the shark already? Like, is the whole season gonna be in Paris? Like, what's going on here? Like, where am I? But it just felt to me like when they do go back to Jersey in episode two, but then when season three rolled around and we were in the city, I was like, oh, this is sort of like the Paris effect happening, where like the show has decided to leave the club for another location, kind of thing. So like it was weird. Like I actually had this, I thought maybe they were doing it in the beginning of season two, but it was just for an episode. I think they're trying to expand it, you know what I mean? Like, it's tough. Like, maybe they just didn't want to pigeonhole themselves and do the idea I said was like, yeah, we don't want to do the 4th of July again. We already did that. Like, let's not repeat ourselves. But, like, then they don't really get into any other sort of aspects of summer, really. I know there's, like, a bachelor party, but they go to, like, Atlantic City. Like, they do cool, like, there's fun episodes. They get into, like, fun stuff and everything, but I don't know. I know where you're coming from. I felt that too a little bit, whereas, like, the beginning of the summer and the end of the summer, not a lot of, like, not a lot to delineate, you know, one from the other.
So then we are thrust into season three and the two episodes that Amy Heckerling directs, Sandwich and A Little Business Proposition, was giving me flashbacks to both Loser, because we see Wheeler in class, but also weirdly to Swingers, because in Swingers, there was this like older attractive couple who was like, hey, David, we want you to film us having sex, and Wheeler was involved. And then here, there's an older attractive couple with his hot teacher, and they want him to be involved in the sex thing too. And it's just like, you guys just did this.
Yeah, that turns out to be a whole different sex thing, though.
It's a different sex thing, but I'm just like, maybe that's the downside of watching three seasons in like 4 days or whatever. But I feel like it's like there was just an older couple trying to lure a younger person into their specific sex, not fetish, but like sex request, right? And then here again, it's the same kind of like, oh, we need your sperm because we want to have a baby. And it's just like, well, you just did, it just felt very, like, very similar when there's not that many stories you're telling in, like, basically 2.5 seasons.
My main takeaway from that episode was the turkey baster line, because that was also in Look Who's Talking. I mean, I liked what they were trying to go for, because I actually enjoyed the direction they were taking Wheeler. Like, as soon as he stopped smoking weed, he became, like, a genius kind of thing. Or he always was smart, but, like, he actually started applying himself and found he had a knack for literature and teaching and stuff. And I think they could have, again, they could have handled that a little better. Maybe it felt rushed. I'm glad they tried to explore, though, the whole, like, surrogate, like, thing. I just wish that they had, taken more time with it and that it actually, like, panned out a lot better. But
well, when Wheeler is talking to David about it, one of them says it's not like a front for Upper West Side vampires, and then the other one says, no, but that's a pretty good idea for a movie. Cute little vamps call out.
I did like that there's an openness in this episode, especially from the teacher, about insemination and ovulation. I was like, oh, that's like right in line with Amy Heckerling and no other directors ever. Because we talked about how that's something that, you know, happens to everyone, right, Kara? And no one talks about it except for Amy Heckerling. And here she is again in an episode where a woman's like, I'm ovulating, like, let's get me knocked up or whatever. And it caught me off guard, but like, I was like, oh, we just talked about this for like a handful of her movies.
Yeah. And the episode Sam Witch. Somebody makes a Midnight Cowboy reference, but back in the episode where David and Sky go to that party in New York City with the giant background dick, as David is walking into that party, he's talking about how he feels like he's in that movie. So, 2 Midnight Cowboy references in these Amy Heckerling directed episodes.
This is also the part of the show where the Japanese are going to take over the club, which I think was sort of teased in season 2, that there's a threat that they're going to buy the club and demolish it and use it for land. And so I thought that there was a great montage in the 3rd episode where, I want to say it's Nash, but maybe it's multiple characters. I just wrote down turning Japanese-ish montage scene, which I feel like it was just another great montage from Amy Heckerling about... Maybe it was about Nash learning Japanese? I don't remember.
No, it's he is learning from Barry is giving him and the golf pro lessons.
Oh, yes, yes, like, yes.
Cultural lessons about Japanese culture so that they can...
Bowing and drinking sake and stuff, yes.
I thought it was kind of funny because that's been Barry's entire vibe. The entire series is like he's always talking about how his home is his dojo, and like he wears kimonos at home, and he's so into that culture and has, you know, adopted it, that it was kind of funny. Like, I liked the payoff that he kind of knew what he was talking about for a minute here and was helping them out.
That montage is so funny, and then it ends with the golf pro suddenly passing out, hitting his head on the table and falling on the floor, and it just cuts there, and that's the end of the episode. Made me laugh.
Which is kind of a little bit of a, not a flashback, but like a throwback or something to Barry falling out of the car on that bachelor party episode and ending up in the hospital with a concussion and then trying to find David Copperfield in Atlantic City. In the 2nd episode, in Sandwich is about where Sam begins to open the restaurant, the sandwich, the deli, or whatever, with the help of his boss from the IRS. There was a great scene, I thought, like a little, again, not really montage, but like a little quick cutting, like tension building, where David is waiting for 3:45 to hand in or to go talk to his boss about like watching his reel. And there was a real sense of tension. Like, I feel like maybe because I was paying more attention to the directing in this episode, but I feel like there were flourishes in her episodes that we didn't really see in other episodes.
So he's going to give his boss his director's reel. And as he's like writing down the word director, he pauses in the middle of it. And then like cuts up to one of those like Felix clocks with the tail ticking back and forth. And it just, the directing of that scene in particular, I think is so brilliant and really does build that tension so effectively.
And I loved it going from like the Felix the Cat clock to another clock to a VCR blinking zero to like a different clock.
To one of those like calculator watches.
Yep. And like it was so cool. In the grand scheme of things, it was a nothing moment. Like he could have just waited a minute and just, you know, handed it in. But like it felt like this like very tense like bomb squad defusing a bomb. It was just masterfully done. It actually reminds me, completely off topic for a second. Mike, I don't know if you watched, I think I might have told you about this forever ago, but there's a movie maybe from Thailand called Bad Genius. Have you seen this?
No.
So Bad Genius is about four high schoolers who are trying to scam the SATs, and there's tension like this, but like stretched for a much longer time because it's like the clock counting down and stuff like that. So compliment, I think, to Amy Heckerling that there's this whole movie that I love that this sort of reminded me of, which is like this tension of a clock building or a clock ticking down or whatever, but ultimately just so that he can go talk to his asshole boss and try to get him to, you know, watch his reel. But great, great, great scene, I think.
Well, we mentioned like on a lot just that how she has a great film language and like she just knows films, and to me like it felt like she was pulling out of like a Western here, like a Sergio Leone moment where like it's like a showdown, you know, except he's having a showdown with the clock instead of a gunslinger. So yeah, it's just great to see how when she does that it comes from a learned place, like it just, we, you know, seen it before in all of her, in her other work, whether it's homage or borrowing or whatever, but like she knows how and when to use that kind of stuff, so it doesn't take you out of anything, and it does quite the opposite. It actually engages you more, so that's really cool. It's just a great style.
This is the episode where we get a bit of like a parental role reversal again, not quite a body swap, but Judy shows up with her young lady friend at David's apartment to use their bathroom, and he winds up having to kind of take care of her and say the exact line that she said to him earlier in the series about getting the place cleaned up by the time he's home from work.
Yeah, I love that. That also might have been, I think, in an Amy Heckerling episode. I think it's an episode where he wakes up just sleeping on the couch, and I think she, you know, she's just furious that he has left this place a mess, so a little bit of a twice come around, both for the line and also within one of her episodes, so.
Yeah, there's also a lot of, like, sexual harassment in her episodes that I think, or at least in the last two, I wrote down under Sandwich, sexual harassment, and then under the next one wrote down, ugh, pervy Dr. Ron. And I'm not sure exactly what I meant by sexual harassment, but I know that it was there, and I picked up on it a lot.
Oh, well, there was probably Dr. Ron hitting on his patient while Misty looks on. And he's like, I just do this with all of them. I told dirty jokes to the men about what, I don't even remember the joke, but she's like, oh, I gotta remember that. And then fucking Dr. Ron just standing her up when he's like, I'm just looking at your, the only way that I'm staying awake is by staring at your boobs. Like, Dr. Ron, like, come on, man. I also feel like maybe, I mean, like, you know, obviously Wheeler is nervous of Dr. Ron because he's a handsome, rich, successful doctor. But, like, it's kind of Dr. Ron that maybe, like, seals the deal that, like, Wheeler's the guy for Misty. Like,
yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know.
He's very similar to her a douchey lifeguard boyfriend from the first season.
I have complicated feelings about Misty, but she's very pretty.
She's very pretty. So Misty's got a crazy Jersey accent. I don't know what her real voice is like.
I know, which for some reason just makes her more hot. I don't understand it.
Do you think Karen or Misty is prettier? I know that's not really a direct comparison because it's more like Karen versus Sky versus Cutie Wardrobe Girl, but I feel like of the blondes with the crazy hair, crazy 80s hair, crazy in good ways, a magnificent hair, I should say.
Yeah, I don't know. Misty really does it for me. I think it's the accent.
It's, you know, it's great. I do love, though, in terms of the characterization, like, it's great, but I feel like there's a missed opportunity because she's in her red lifeguard outfit for so much of the show, whereas Karen's outfit is just, like, wonderfully neon-colored leotards and, like, and leggings and stuff, and, like, that really, the wardrobe, like, Karen's wardrobe is on point.
All of the wardrobe in this, I think, is so, so good.
Anything else to say about Red Oaks, other than Nash is the best?
Oh, Nash is gonna go work at Mar-a-Lago?
There's several references that they make to Rudy Giuliani, who was Attorney General, or State's Attorney of New York at that time. And then at some point, somebody's reading a magazine with Donald Trump on the cover, and they show that.
Yeah, Trump's kind of a through line through a lot of this. But any other thoughts about Red Oaks before we have a quick sort of recap of sorts of Amy Heckerling and this run of Cinemakers, or?
Yeah, not really. I did watch a bunch of her other TV shows, though, that I can talk about.
Carrie Diaries. Well, you said another one or two that I already forget. Oh, Gossip Girl.
Yeah. Well, I started with the Fast Times TV show because they adapted that from the movie.
With its wild opening.
Oh my God, so wild. There's only 3/4 of one of the episodes that she directed that is online. It's called What is Life, which was written by her, directed by her. And in that episode, Brad has an existential crisis while rehearsing for the school talent show and then like tries to talk to his peers about death and whether they're afraid of death and, like, why aren't they thinking about this stuff, and tries to talk to some of the teachers about it and, like, can't really have the conversation that he wants to have until he gets stoned with Spicoli in his van, and Spicoli is, like, the only one who gets it.
So it's the same characters but different actors?
Correct. Patrick Dempsey plays Damone, which is weird casting.
Is Brad's bud in it?
Brad's bud? I don't know. I didn't look at the full cast list. I'm not sure if anyone was cast as that.
Brad's bud is Nicolas Cage, so unfortunately.
But that was interesting. She worked on that TV show for a little while.
You said that that was important because that's where she met Mona May, right?
Yes, that is correct. And then there was the show Baby Talk, which was adapted from the Look Who's Talking movies.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know how much she worked on that, because she has a writing credit, but it's just based on characters created by, and she's not listed as a producer or anything, so I don't know if she worked on that at all, and if so, how much. But that was basically the gap between the second Look Who's Talking movie and when she made Clueless, and then...
Did you watch that show?
What, the Baby Talk? No. I did watch a few episodes of the Clueless TV series, which she was an executive producer on, directed 4 episodes of, and then has a created by, written by credit for 62 episodes because it's based on her script. And she wrote 4 episodes.
Wow. There was more crossover there in terms of actors, right? Like Dion stuck around and Murray stuck around?
Dion stuck around, Murray stuck around.
Wallace Shawn, was he in there?
Yeah, but he plays, I mean, he's still Mr. Hall, but Mr. Hall is something else, I think. Twink Kaplan comes back as Miss Geist, but now Miss Geist is a guidance counselor. It's interesting. I didn't love it. And I know that Heckerling had a hard time working on that series because not only was she answering to Paramount, she was also having to answer to the TV network. It was on UPN. No, it was on something else first, and then it moved to UPN. I don't remember. But I Could Never Be Your Woman, the movie in which Michelle Pfeiffer plays a TV show producer, is based a lot on her experience working on the Clueless TV series. So that's interesting.
Did that give you any more like insight into that, or just sort of found the irony and the frustrations because of that?
Yeah, more of that second thing that you said. And also, like, the costumes aren't quite as great. Mona May worked on the TV show too, but obviously much smaller budget, much quicker turnaround time, that sort of thing. So the costumes aren't great, but there are some pieces I appreciate. And that was in 1990, that ran 1996 to 1999. And in that time she made Loser in 1999, I think. And then made I Can Never Be Your Woman, and then directed one episode from the first season of the American version of The Office, in which Amy Adams plays a, like, purse saleswoman who comes into the office to sell her purses. And Michael refers to her as Pam 6.0. Pam is their receptionist, so.
Which is not wrong. I mean, maybe it's not funny, but.
It's not wrong. Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Amy Adams is really, really great, and Jenna Fisher is good, but Amy Adams is a goddess.
So there's a lot of sexual harassment. Michael and Dwight both get very inappropriate with her. Pam feels relieved that there's somebody else to take the heat off of her. I found it very stressful, the whole episode. And then there were 2 episodes of Gossip Girl that she directed, an episode in season 5 and season 6, which was interesting. I watched, like, maybe the first couple episodes of the first season of Gossip Girl, so I had, like, an idea of who most of the characters were, but I hadn't watched anything in between, and so I didn't really have any idea what was going on.
XOXO Gossip Girl.
Yeah, but in the season 5 episode that she directed, she cast her daughter Molly to play a bit part, and also used a song by her band, and also played the guy, or also cast the guy, the Coke guy from Vamps, who is like the drummer of her band. I don't know if he's also her drummer in real life, but he plays a cop in that episode.
Gossip Girl is Leighton Meester and Blake Lively, right? Is that show?
That is correct, yes.
I know some things. I've never seen a minute of it, but my sister watched it, and people I was friends with at Ramapo watched it.
There you go. In the season 6 episode, though, Michelle Trachtenberg was in it. I didn't realize. Apparently, she had a recurring role on that show, yeah. And the whole time, I was, like, watching it, like, I have a distinct feeling, like, this is, like, Veronica Mars, but if she was rich. And then it turns out that Kristen Bell actually does the voiceover on that show. So that's why.
Really?
Yeah, I was surprised. I didn't know that.
On the entire show?
Yeah, apparently. Yeah, but a lot of really, really wonderful shots of New York City. I don't know if they have like a separate crew that do all of those, because that's part of the show. But if Heckerling directed those, they were great. So that's Gossip Girl. Also, I was thinking about how Gossip Girl, or whether Gossip Girl is a direct descendant of Clueless with that voiceover, the way that Clueless has that, which also is a perfect segue to talking about the Carrie Diaries, because much like Sex and the City.
Well, actually, hold on, just real quick before we get there, is Veronica Mars just gritty Clueless? Because there's voiceover there again, where instead of being separated parents, but instead of having a wealthy, successful dad, she's got a great father, but struggling to make ends meet, sort of. Edgy backstory, date raped and, you know, left for nothing in at a party before the series starts. It's just like, it's Cher if everything broke bad, kind of.
The Carrie Diaries, though, also has a voiceover, which they're actually pulling directly from Sex and the City, but is Sex and the City a direct descendant of Clueless? I was wondering about that also. I don't know. I didn't watch a ton of it, but I loved these episodes of the Carrie Diaries that I watched. I was really surprised, because the episodes of Gossip Girl were kind of, and the episode of The Office were all kind of harrowing, and I was just kind of like, when is this going to be over? So that was a really nice refresh. An actress from Doctor Who showed up as Carrie's boss, which was really exciting, and I cried when I saw her, because I wasn't expecting it, and she's not in a lot of stuff, so that was exciting.
I do want to point back to, on our Clueless episode, I sort of made the joke about how there is BC before Cher, and Anno Domini in the year of our Cher, and, like, it's very true, like, that show, directly or indirectly, did impact probably everything that you're talking about, whether it's specifically, like, let's draw inspiration from that, or just, like, the fact that Clueless exists gives rise to a different kind of story and different kind of character and all that sort of stuff. So what became a joke, or what started as a joke, is actually very insightful. So
yeah,
good job, us.
In one of the episodes of the Carrie Diaries, there is a scene that really reminded me of what we've seen from Heckerling a few times, where a couple is making out or about to have sex or something, and we actually see the woman thinking, and we also see some of her perspective. Like, we got a bit of that in Fast Times at Ridgemont High in that dugout scene. We actually, like, see from her perspective looking at the ceiling. I feel like in Look Who's Talking, there's, like, a little bit of that in there, too. And in this episode, Carrie's father is making out with a woman on the couch, and you see her face thinking and looking into the kitchen, and then you see her perspective looking at dirty dishes in the sink from the couch as she's making out because she can't relax. And I just thought that was an interesting viewpoint that we don't see a lot. And then the third episode of the Carrie Diaries, I talked about before, about one of the characters thinking that he might have AIDS, and that being a very moving episode, really good drama directing. Then there was an episode of Suburgatory, which is not available to stream anywhere, so I did not watch that. But Jeremy Sisto, who played Elton in Clueless, is on that show. But I hate him, so I'm glad I didn't have to watch that episode. And then there was an episode of a show called Rake, which starring Greg Kinnear, who was in Loser.
Was that on Showtime?
Maybe, probably. It was it had been an Australian show that was adapted for the United States, and he just plays an asshole who's an asshole to everyone. I don't like those kinds of shows. So I wrote down a lot of good people on this show, but I hate it. And that was the only note I took. And that's it. I'm done. That's a lot of TV. Yeah.
Well, and we're done, really. So, Kara, thank you. I mean, so this run of Cinemakers was not always great. There were some real clunkers in here, at least three of them. But it gave me reason to finally watch Red Oaks. It gave me reason to rewatch Fast Times and Clueless, and gave me one of my new favorite, unexpectedly favorite movies in Look Who's Talking, and also saw some other movies that I really liked, not on that level, but I can never be your woman in Vamps. So thank you for being so pro-female director, pro-Amy Heckerling, encouraging us to do this, and this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was. And now I have a favorite director. I've never had one before, and it's totally Amy Heckerling, and it makes so much sense. It all makes sense.
So I guess the thing that we sort of been teasing, I think, last episode and this episode, is that there's rumors that she ghost-directed part of or all of Night of the Roxbury, which I have never seen.
Mm-hmm. Which she did also produce. She has, like, a full producer credit on that.
So we may cover that next week. I'm not sure. That's still TBD. But this is, in terms of, you know, how high the highs were, you know, we've talked about it sort of throughout as a kind of a bummer, but, like, there should be more. Like, anybody who makes Fast Times and Clueless, like, let her do more stuff.
Yeah, definitely want another Amy Heckerling movie. I mean, Vamps was such a nice surprise. Like, that was such a good discovery. Yeah, I mean, like, the average here was good, I feel. Like, we did pretty well. I mean, you know, I think I like Johnny Dangerously a little more than the rest of the crowd. But all in all, you know, really glad we did this. This has been a really good time. And, yeah, you know, I mean, come on. Between, like, Clueless, Fast Times, and Look Who's Talking, like, those are, that solidifies her in my mind as, like, a great director, you know, and, like, she did great work after that that just hasn't gotten recognized, and I just really hope, that she gets another shot and gets a chance to make another movie, because I am there. I have that ticket.
So, I have a question for both of you, which is, if you could pitch something for Amy Heckerling to make. It doesn't have to be a full story. I know I'm putting you on the spot, but like maybe a genre or like a type of movie, what would you have her do?
Musical.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Sci-fi, definitely. How about a sci-fi musical?
I think that sounds like a great idea.
I think just because, Kara, I just read this weekend that thing from New York Times or the New Yorker or whatever about how like she always saw it as a musical. So now I just got sort of a musical Clueless on the brain. So I want to see her do that.
Oh, I'm happy to report that Clueless the musical, which just wrapped its run, actually totally sold out. So I'm very happy that like it was a success.
I would also like to see her do a documentary of some kind about New York.
Yeah, that would be great. Oh, that was another thing that I watched. She appears in a documentary called If These Knishes Could Talk, The Story of the New York Accent, which is a documentary about the New York accent, which I had seen before and apparently completely erased from my brain because I started watching it and was like, oh no, I've seen this. Interesting. But it's interesting. I mean, it's like on a technical level, not a great documentary, but it's an interesting subject matter. And I would love to see her get behind the wheel on a doc. That'd be cool.
You know, Mike, I was thinking about comparing Amy Heckerling to our two other directors we've done full runs of. I would say the average not as high as Christopher Nolan, but we also knew exactly what we were getting into with him from start to finish, that all three of us had seen all of his movies, except I don't think Chris had seen Dunkirk. But for the most part, we've all seen all of his movies. I would say the average was about on par with Soderbergh, right? Like,
yeah, just because of his sheer volume of Soderbergh.
Yes. Soderbergh had more clunkers, but, you know, still, like, a handful of, like, perfect movies, and then also a bunch of stuff that I'd never want to see again or think about again. But I also think we kind of, in a way, developed a structure, and again, not that this podcast needs any more rules, but sort of alternating between, like, directors where I haven't seen, maybe this is just for me, I don't know, but alternating between directors where, like, I've seen, like, maybe half of it, but not all of it, and then directors that we've seen all of it. And then again, here, this is sort of a mixed bag. And then next, I don't know who we're doing next. We've talked about maybe doing Tarantino, maybe doing the Wachowskis, but both of those people, or all three of those people, I've seen all their movies. But I kind of think there's, like, there's value in, like, sort of staggering between, like, seeing things for the first time and then going deep on stuff that, like, we know that we love. You know what I mean? So, Amy Heckerling, I think, like Soderbergh, it was like there's stuff that we know that we love, but it's also like, I've literally never heard of Vamps. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, I'd love to discover more movies and see more movies I haven't seen. See more movies for the first time from directors that I love, you know, like discover movies from directors that I'm really into. But I think also what's kind of, I don't know, for me, what I liked about this is that we've sort of broke that rule that we, you know, forged early on where we were like, we're only going to do auteurs from a certain year forward. And, you know, this just opens like the door. I hope you're in agreement that now maybe the door's just wide open and we're just going to do auteurs from any time throughout history, you know, like we don't necessarily need to do modern auteurs, but maybe we'll do, you know, lots of films from the 60s one day or the 50s, who knows. Just, you know, that opens the door for so much more variety in general. So yeah, I'm excited.
Well, outside of the fact of whether or not we do Night of the Roxbury next, our next one-off director has been selected. I don't know how to say this kind of without laughing. It's one of my friends who has made two movies. He's made two horror movies. It's my friend Matt Stewarts, who has made a movie called Rewind and a movie called Tonight She Comes. They're both horror movies. Mike and I are going to do this, I think, solo bolo. Watch the two, talk about the two, and then we're going to have Matt on and sort of interview him about making movies, making these movies, ideas, what's coming next. What's actually kind of cool, because I'm friends with him and I follow him on Twitter and I'm friends with him on Facebook, some horror blog just picked up like 10 movies to, or 10 either underseen movies in 2018 or 10 movies to watch for in 2019, and number one was Tonight She Comes. So he's kind of, hopefully, theoretically, because he's a great guy, an up-and-coming director. He's only made the two so far, so we're going to do your old compare-contrast. Tonight She Comes is gross. Like, it is real gross.
Gross in what way? Because I feel like that could go in several different directions.
There's a lot of blood. There's also a lot of, like, blood, like, female blood.
Menstrual blood, you mean. Okay.
Yes. The old Aunt Flo.
The hallway from The Shining? Is that what we're talking about here?
Yes. It's my favorite GIF.
I only saw it once because I watched Rewind twice in the same night, and I was like, oh shit, I love this. This is so weird and cool. I love that. Then Tonight She Comes, I was like, oh my god, like, when is this movie going to be over? Not because I didn't like it, but I was just like, it was uncomfortable.
Endurance test kind of thing. I've seen the first movie. I liked it. It's pretty cool. I'm excited to talk to him and to see Tonight She Comes because it was on my list last October for Halloween and I didn't get around to it and I didn't know he made it. So that was kind of a cool surprise because I'd heard this movie. So this is going to be cool. And this also is just like, you know, we're not doing someone everybody knows, then maybe, you know, we can create some awareness through our show or something. But like, yeah, this is just in line with opening the doors, just giving, you know, people a look at people's work you may not consider or hear or know about or something. And yeah, so I'm really looking forward to that.
So I was even saying to him, I was just like, Soderbergh, Fetty Alvarez, Christopher Nolan, the RKSS, Amy Hackerling, Matt Stewart. It's like, well, okay, but you know, it's cool. Like, he's a great dude. I'm looking forward to talking to him about these movies. He's not a household name. We're not a household name, but a great, you know, pairing of the minds, and maybe we'll all explode in popularity because of this episode, so who knows? Sometime later this year, I'll look for that.
Good luck with that.
Well, thank you. But in the meantime, check out Wistful Thinking, check out the Tom Tom Club, Mike and I are doing Tom Hanks, Tom Cruise podcasts, check out Too Fast, Too Forever, check out Third Time's a Charm, check out all 24 shows or whatever at cageclub.me. Go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram, email cinemakers@cageclub.me. We will read it on our Matt Stewart's episode, if not our Neither Roxbury episode, if that happens. Patreon.com/cageclub, support us. Choose who we do next. That's a cool way to do that. And again, Kara, just thank you for the Amy Hackerling run.
Well, thank you for having me on. This was very fun.
And I also do love how, like, pretty much every episode of Wistful Thinking since we started recording this, you have mentioned Amy Hackerling in one way or the other. So we have forever changed your brain chemistry, I think, to infuse more Amy Hackerling into it. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Kara Gail O'Regan.
And we'll see you next time, whenever it is, for whatever it is, right here on Cinemakers.